Psycho Man.
Hello, boys and girls, and welcome to episode 422 of the Motorcycle Man podcast and another interview. And joining me today here in the V-Twin Cafe is Drew Faulkner from the Moto Adventurer blog and Moto Adventurer Unscripted podcast. And today, we're going to talk about the lightweight ADV market. But first, the Motorcycle Man podcast is brought to you by Scorpion Helmets. Now, they're offering high-quality, innovative motorcycle helmets and technical apparel at an incredible value. So to learn more, get on over to ScorpionUSA.com. And Wild Ass Seats. You can improve your comfort and ability to stay in the saddle longer with a cushion from Wild Ass Seats. So if you're tired of those painful pressure points and fatigue, get on over to wild-ass.com and tell the real Craig Johnson that the Motorcycle Man podcast sent you on over. Get your cushion today. And of course, as always, Tobacco Motorwear for the best in casual riding gear for men and women. There's only one place you should be going, and that is Tobacco Motorwear. Visit them at tobaccomotorwear.com, and our listeners get 10% off your order when you use the code MOTOMEN. Everyone here at the podcast is wearing tobacco riding jeans and a California riding shirt, and I love this stuff. Wonderful products. I wear them for every ride. I won't ride without them. Hey, your safety is worth it, so get on over to Tobacco Motorwear. Get in Dave's pants. All right, boys and girls, hello, this is Ted, and we're here in the V-Twin Cafe, and joining me today, all the way from, now let me see if I remember, you're in Kentucky or you're in West Virginia?
Actually, Dayton, Ohio, but Everybody always thinks Kentucky because I'm there so much.
I know, that's okay. We got Drew Faulkner from the Moto Adventurer blog, and you got your podcast. What's the name of your podcast?
Moto Adventurer Unscripted.
Oh, okay, so very good. Drew, welcome to the show.
I'm happy to be here, sir.
Yeah, I'm glad you could make it. How you doing, man? How you been?
Dude, it has been a harsh winter up here in southern Ohio, so I'm doing what I can to stay sane. So,
how much snow do you have?
It's not been a lot of snow. I mean, we got like 8 inches one day in mid-January, which we haven't had 8-inch snow in a long time. We got a couple dumped on us the other day, which has been one of those, like, it's 10, it's 20, it'll get up to 34, and a little bit of melt, and then it just, you know, goes right back into the deep freeze. Like, we haven't had a hard winter like this probably, I don't know, 10 years.
You know, it's wintertime. It happens. Yeah. It's going to happen. You're going to have ebb and flow. You're going to have a mild winter. You're going to have nothing. You're going to have a normal winter, and then you're going to get hit hard. That happens. So I was talking to some people today. I used to have a farm in upstate New York.
Yeah.
All right. And I was talking to some people who are in the same area where I had. They got 9 feet of snow.
That's a serious winter.
And there are some spots where they have 25 feet by the ski resort.
Yeah.
25 feet. Can you imagine that? Oh, my God.
Oh, it's fire and brimstone, right? Like, I would be waiting for, you know, life to end all across the globe if that happened.
That's just insane. It's insane. Yeah. It's just absolutely crazy. So, Drew, for those who don't know who you are, tell us who you are, your motorcycle self, what you do.
I'm a mechanical engineer moonlighting as a moto journalist, I think is probably the best way to say it. So, I run a blog, obviously, or a website, motoadventure.com, and obviously I have the podcast. I'm also a motorcycle rally promoter. I host a rally. This will be the, was it 9th year since 2017, Red River Scramble.
Is it really that long?
Yeah, already? 2017, we did the first Red River Scramble meetup in Red River Gorge, Kentucky. And so we're still doing that. Last year, I had over 500 people register.
No kidding. Congratulations.
The Hurricane Helene kind of put a damper on
no pun intended.
Yeah, all the actual attendance, as it turned out. But because it was one of those things where everybody was like so geared up to go. And then this hurricane came out of nowhere. I don't know how many people, obviously, you know, everyone knows the news from North Carolina, but I didn't believe it was coming to Kentucky, and I've never seen a weather forecast in my life as accurate as that one was. But anyway, we've been having an adventure rally in Eastern Kentucky for a long time. So I'm the promoter guy for that whole thing. And so I'm, you know, I live in the adventure dual sport space, spent some time racing cross country dirt bikes, spent some time cross country racing adventure bikes. So if it has a plate and it goes on dirt, I like it.
There you go. What are you riding now?
I still have my 2013 Triumph Scrambler in the garage. Quite heavily modified since you and I talked at length the last time.
Yeah.
I just bought a leftover 23 Tenere 700 last spring. I have a 2019 WR250R dual sport, and I still, at least currently, have an 883 Sportster.
Oh, well, look at that. So you've got quite the garage going on there, huh?
Don't say that too loud. My wife's in the other room. She'll hear you.
So she's not allowed in the garage, is that what it is?
Yeah, she's put up with it. COVID's good and bad, right? Like, it's a long discussion, yeah, but the motorcycle market's nuts. And I think it's related to today's conversation. So, you know, I bought bikes on the early side of COVID, and I sold some of them for profit. So I sold a race bike, and I bought the Sportster and my WR with the proceeds from that race bike, because that's how sought after two-stroke enduro bikes were when I sold it. So, I mean, it is what it is.
Yeah. But, you know, the ADV market is a whole nother thing. And in one of your recent blogs, you were talking about the lightweight ADV market. Now, this is going to be the topic of our conversation today. And is that market, the lightweight ADV market, is that finally becoming a thing?
I think the future's here, and I think it's a confluence of a lot of things. I think you can tell with KTM coming in with a whole brand new 390 that is high-end spec, them coming in with that at this point, and I also think that we're all looking around realizing that the economy is a little, we'll call it shaky for lack of a better term, right? We don't know what's going to happen next, but most people alive today don't remember the last time they've seen it like this, right? I was too young for that, but I'm sure this is very 80s, if not 70s-ish, to a lot of people who are old enough to know.
Sure.
So I think, because you look at, I'll use Triumph as an example. Like, look how much a Triumph Tiger cost at this point, right? Like,
it's crazy.
So
it's freaking crazy. Oh my God.
Triumph Tiger 900 Rally Pro is the same price that in 2014, a Tiger 1200 was. Actually, it's more than what a Tiger 1200 was back then. Because I think a Tiger 1200 was 15.5. And so now you're looking at almost 18 grand for a Tiger 900 Rally Pro, right? So I think that cost-conscious people, people that are trading down to a lighter bike, people who are getting into more off-road but still want the creature comforts, like, there's a whole host of reasons why I think the smaller market is ripe at this stage. And there's a lot of history here.
Oh, yeah, but, you have to, when you look at the market, there's this massive gap. Because you have your bikes near the $20,000 mark, and then you have your bikes below the $10,000 mark, and there's this massive hole in the middle, and there's nothing sitting in there right now, which is, I think, where you're going to see this lightweight ADV market happen.
Well, it's even better than that. Obviously, the Tenere came on the scene, 2021 were the first ones you could get in the States, and it was, $9,999, so 10 grand, and you could get a T7. Yeah. And then the Triumphs and the other European brands have kind of creeped up, but KTM 890, and none of these are lightweight. These are all middleweight, in my opinion. So that's what I'm saying, is now you can get lightweight. Royal Enfield? No, BMW's 310 GS. Yeah, $5,700. Mind you.
Now, see, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. So
that's quite affordable, actually.
Yeah. So then that's my point, is that, from $5,000 to $9,000, there's a lot of options in there. And at this stage, it's $4,500? I don't have it in front of me, but for a Honda Grom, to me, that's the base model, right? Like, a Honda Grom is the smallest street legal thing you can get, essentially.
Yeah.
Short of a scooter, but yeah.
But, the thing is, at that $6,000 mark, can you get something better for that same price? And it's almost like what's the point? If I can spend $6,000 and get this, well, I could spend a couple extra $1,000 and get this, right?
So, right.
But this brings me to, while the market right now, there's plenty. Oh my God, between Honda, Kawasaki, and Yamaha, just those three alone, the XC enduro and dual sport market is freaking insane. There's so many of them, but the lightweight market or the midsize market, why does that mean so much for the market, and how desperate is that needed?
Well, let's define that first, right? Because we threw out middleweight and lightweight. To me, I would define anything as lightweight ADV as basically anything above, we'll call it 250 cc's and up in the U.S. and probably under, let's say under 650. And the other thing here is I think a lot of people throw dual sport in with adventure, and that's fine, right? Everybody gets to define words however they want. Sure. To me, it's like if it comes with a factory windscreen, that's when I start to consider it like ADV. It sounds stupid, right? I'd be like, what do you mean? I'm like, come on now. Like ADV is like 51% road, 49% off-road. Dual sport is typically either 50-50 or the other way around. They don't give you a windscreen on a dual sport because they don't expect you to stay on the highway, right? ADV means get on the highway, right? It's all semantics, and I get it, and we can, you know, stat sheet race all day, but yeah, so you've got, you know, CRF 250L Rally, CRF 300L Rally, and those have been out, you know, for a while on the bottom end, and they go up, you know, now you've got the new Himalayan 450, I'm trying to think what comes to mind, the KTM, well, we mentioned the KTM 390 versus 300X, like a lot of these other bikes have been in this space, so I wanted to kind of define that. Your question was, what makes it important? Is that what your question was?
I think I know the answer to it, but I want to hear your
on a personal level. To me, affordability is first. Like I expect to see the squeeze coming. I mean, you're already seeing tons. I mean, I bought a leftover bike last year, Tenere 700s. People were collecting MSRP on Tenere 700s the year before last. And now you can get incentives on a brand new one. People are trying to sell a used bike for the same price as new, and now you get incentives, right? Like, we can tell the economy's going
the other
way.
In some cases, I've seen them for more.
All of a sudden, like, I've spent $5,000, and I'm getting all of it back out of it. Good luck with that, buddy. I think affordability is the first thing that's on the forefront. I also think that there's a generational shift. Obviously, I host a motorcycle rally. I see lots of people. I think as folks are getting older, they're realizing that the bikes are getting heavier, and either they want to maintain their current interest, or they're actually more interested in spending more time off-road. And they're like, I don't need a 1200 GS to have fun. And ironically, what goes with that, lots of people get these big bikes and they actually trailer them to rallies. And so it's like, well, if I'm trailering a big bike to a rally anyway, I might as well just get a small bike because I don't need, you know, they're not getting the benefit of the big bike and all the big farkles. So it's like, why not buy a smaller bike?
Why not ride the big bike to the rally?
We can definitely talk about that, right? I like to tease my friends like, ah, some nice trailer trash you got there. I also think I'm seeing more spouses get involved, which is really awesome. I have a friend of mine that I used to race dirt bikes with, and his wife started racing, and he got hurt and decided to sell his dirt bike. And so he bought a T7, and his wife got a KTM 390. And so now they're both doing that. But she wanted something that's her seat height. The smaller bikes that tend to fit both the female frame better, anybody who's a little bit shorter, obviously the weight's easier to manage both because it's lighter and because the seat height's lower. Like, everybody wins in this case. And I think there's the other side, and it's that I see most adventure riders are street riders that decide they want to move into the dirt.
I want to dabble.
Yeah, I have friends that are racers that are getting into adventure riding, and I laugh because I'm like, you're actually going upstream. You wouldn't think that because that doesn't make sense, right? You would think you would grow up riding dirt bikes and go, I'm going to get an adventure bike and kind of chill out, right? It's one of those, like, I had sport bikes my whole life and then I bought a Harley. Like, everybody's heard that story, right?
Yeah, of course.
But it's interesting because the ADV space, to me, predominantly seems the other way around. Is that, people become, dirt curious, right?
Of course.
And I think the lightweight space is prime for that too, that it's like, if you're going to do it, then you can do it with a cheap one, and it's not the same expense as buying a 500 pound pig for $20,000 and beating the crap out of it and hating yourself.
Right, of course. But you know what I've noticed now, while I'm going through this article and even looking at some other articles I've seen on the ADV market, some of the smaller bikes, there seems to be this massive gap between 450 and 1,000.
Yeah.
There's a massive gap in there. And I think there needs... Now, granted, we have the Wii Strom of 650, right? Yeah. But that, you don't see much in the 650 to 950 range. You don't see much in there at all. And I'm just wondering if that wouldn't fit this... We'll call it midsize or lightweight.
Yeah, well, and that is the catch, right? Like, I've when I'm saying this, I'm saying like 650 and down, but you're not wrong. Like, the middle weight is, let's call it that 600 to 1,000. We now have Aprilia has the Touareg 660. I don't know if you've looked at that.
No, I have not.
Aprilia has the Tour X660. Moto Guzzi has their V85 TT. I'm actually big fans of both of those bikes. They don't catch the press because, first of all, the Moto Guzzi is by far much more of an adventure touring type bike.
Okay.
And with guys like, you know, Paul Terrace on the T7 nowadays, it's like, sweet, let's race adventure bikes, even though most of us are not doing that, right? I'm trying to think what else is in that 660 low end, but obviously we talked about the T7. Triumph has got tons of options. But most of them are not spoke wheels at this stage, which is interesting.
Right. Well, you got the Tigers. You know, they're at the 900 area. Right.
But they now have. So there's if we're talking sport touring or adventure touring, there's now the Tiger 660, the Tiger 800, the Tiger 850, the Tiger 900.
So they filled the gap. Yeah. They were smart doing that. Yeah. That's true. That's attraction because that gives the buying public an option.
Yeah.
But who else is doing that?
Suzuki also has the V-Strom 800 DE. Is that what that is? I think that's right. So that's on there as well.
You're going to make me look it up, aren't you?
It's funny because you said lightweight. It's like I have a list of what I call lightweights on there, but if we're talking middleweights, and the price point's the other thing, right? Because right now Honda's TransAlp 750 at $9,999 is arguably the cheapest middleweight. Now we can have an argument of, do you want to put the KLR 650 in there?
You know what? Not for anything. It changes. I freaking hate that bike. I just hate that bike. First of all, it's the ugliest thing I've ever seen life. It is the ugliest thing. And I'm just, everybody's always, it's reliable to a point.
As long as the doohickey's done right. You know what's funny on paper? Because I'm always like, I'm the self-identified Luddite, right? Like I'm always like, what's the older solution or what's the simple, cheap solution first? I was shocked that on paper I loved the KLR for years and always brought it up, and I finally went to ride one and I'm like, I can't believe this. Like, I was in shock. I'm like, I hate riding this bike. Like, it tears my soul to shreds because I'm like the cheapest man on the planet, and I'm like, how can I hate this bike? But it's like my emotions could not get along with the engine character at all. Like, I couldn't do it. Like, so I'm a twins guy, right? Like, I've got Sportsters and Triumphs and, you know, Yamahas in the garage.
You got a single thumper. You just like,
yeah.
But okay, getting to Suzuki, they got the 650, the 650 XT, the 650 XT Adventure, the 800, the 800 Touring, the 800 DE, the 800 DE Adventure. Then of course they go to the 1050, the 1050.
That's all trim garbage, right? That's all the car market that's all did to them. Yeah.
So, basically, you have the 650, the 800, and then the 1050.
Yeah.
That's what they got there. So
Honda's now doing, you can get 300L Rally, 500, 750, and 1,000 from Honda now. KTM's got a 790, got an 890. There's quite a bit in middle range. To the point, right? Like, I think the middleweight range, I wouldn't call it fleshed out. Like, I think there's a lot more to come here. Like I've got, you know, I've done podcasts and articles about my beef with the way Honda's basically completely specced up the 1,000, right? Like, your heaviest, most expensive bike has all the great trinkets on it, and all your smaller bikes don't have any of the niceties as far as off-road suspension and stuff goes.
Right.
But I see a market for that. And I think as long as Yamaha has guys like Paul Terrace, and I don't know, are you familiar with Cody Webb?
No, I am not.
Cody Webb is very experienced. He's a championship trials rider here from the U.S., and I think he's from Colorado, if I recall. Like, don't quote me on that. But he's also won, like the big Erzberg Rally or Erzberg Hare Scramble in Germany and Hard Enduro and all this other stuff, right? So he just recently left Sherco and started riding for Yamaha, and they're giving him a T7. So now we're going to have a domestic guy who's going to be, you know, doing crazy stuff on the T7. So I think the more this stuff happens, the more that the middleweight range is going to have more pressure to put high-performance parts on some of these otherwise, you know, adventure touring bikes.
Right. Well, yeah, you know, I'm looking at Yamaha right now. Basically, you have the Tenere 700.
Yeah, there's a pretty big gap there.
Yeah, there's a huge gap. And then, boom, then you're down to the XTs.
Yeah.
And the TWs, and there's nothing else. So Yamaha's falling behind there a little bit.
I think I see something on the horizon with Yamaha. So I think soon we'll see something come out this way.
Well, you know, I want to ask you this question while I got there. Of all the manufacturers out there, Who do you think is leading in the lightweight market? And of those in that market, who is completely missed the mark?
Well, so if we're still talking lightweight as I defined it on the bottom end, I'm actually going to say that I feel like Honda and Royal Enfield are the ones that are doing the right things and are taking this in the right direction.
Dude, I love the freaking Himalayan.
Right.
I love the freaking Himalayan. I don't know why. I just love that bike.
It was the genesis for the article that I wrote was actually news that Hero was bringing the X-Pulse 421 to market. That's what they're calling it. They're making a 421 adventure bike. And it hit me immediately because to me, the first real like lightweight ADV bike was the Himalayan 410. Technically, there's some other bikes that are arguably older, but Royal Enfield kind of pushed the Himalayan to the forefront, like at EICMA Motorcycle Show, I think, in 2016-ish. Mm-hmm. Technically, I think Benelli had their TRK 502, but then we start getting an argument about what's actually going on in Asia, because, you know, we only see how many percentage of bikes, like if you go to Asia, how many more motorcycle manufacturers, how many more engine sizes there are. We don't see any of that stuff here, right? Yeah. So I think that TRK was actually something they brought here that was existing someplace else. Don't quote me. Anyway, but then on the heels of Royal Enfield coming out with the Himalayan, then that's when the BMW brought the 310 GS. That's when Honda brought the CRF 250 Rally to market. I think that was a 2017, 2018 type of thing. Kawasaki adventurized their Ninja 300 and came out with the Versys X. And then that was it for a while. And so now, to me, I see how much movement is coming out of India. Because the KTM 390, when it was launched in 2020, that's a Bajaj bike. I don't know if you're familiar with that at all.
I've never heard Bajaj.
Yeah, so KTM has a partnership with Bajaj. And, oh man, you'll have to look this up to make sure I'm not totally crapping the bed here. I believe Bajaj has a relationship with Triumph because I believe the new Scrambler 400s are also made in India. And for the life of me, I can't remember if it was Bajaj that they're partnered with or not. But they're a huge manufacturer in India. And so a previous article that I had published was ultimately that we need to understand that we live in a world today where the German population and the Japanese population, they're declining. So they may have engineering work that's being done in these countries, but the vast majority of the labor is being done someplace else. Yeah. So, you know, Japanese bikes, Triumph bikes are outsourced to Southeast Asia. Now KTM is outsourcing their bike to Bajaj. They're outsourcing their bike to CF Moto in China. So they may own the intellectual property, but they're outsourcing the labor because they don't have young people in their countries to do these things. India, on the other hand, has they're now the most populated country on Earth, and they have a birth rate above replacement rate, which we don't have in the United States. We definitely don't have in Europe. They haven't had in Japan since before the 90s, right? So I'm like, when I see, what is the name of that company? TVS, I think, is the other big brand in India, Bajaj, Hero, and Royal Enfield. I'm like, yeah, like they're experienced in this space because, you know, a 125 is a reasonable size motorcycle and everywhere else in the world except here in America, right? Yeah. So, and that's when I'm like, they're bringing, you know, what they would consider premium bikes and they're coming into the U.S. and they're very experienced in the space. So I do think Royal Enfield is the one that's kind of pushing the market and is the leader here. And I'm going to hat tip to Honda because I used to have a 250L. The 300L Rally is a highly, highly underrated bike. That is a wonderful motorcycle.
But you know, it's funny because I'm sure, like most people out there who watches YouTube, everybody watches Itchy Boots.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Okay. So in the beginning, she was nothing but the Himalayan.
Yeah.
And she was on the 250 doing all that. So I'm sure that drove a lot of interest with that. And then, of course, you know, she went on to a Honda after that.
Yeah.
And then now she's on this 80s, old school. 19, it was old Tenere from the 80s. But I'm sure that has had a lot of influence on it. But now that Himalaya's come out with this 450, and I had a chance to see it, not ride it, but I had a chance to see it up at Sturgis last year. And it's a really nice freaking bike.
It's similar to the Pan America, the Himalayan 450. If you like it in a picture, wait till you see it in person. It's even better. It looks
It's a good looking bike. I'm very eager to ride one. And the thing is, does the 250 market fit that same lightweight ADV thing you're talking about?
Well, that's what's cool, right, is Honda in, was it 21? They bumped the CRF 250L up to 300. So now, and that was the thing, right? So I had a CRF 250L dual sport, not the rally, and I had it for 10,000 miles. I mean, I rode it from Dayton to Kentucky, 180 miles one way, rode off-road, rode back home. I raced it. Like, I did everything with that bike. That bike needs an oil change every 8,000 miles. Like,
oh, damn.
You can beat the tar out of a CRF 300 or a CRF 250L. Like, they're just made to be abused. They're amazing bikes. So the issue, it had six gear, which is awesome, but I would, like, ride it to work, and it was like, yeah, if you're going to do 70 on the highway, you better get good at drafting. Like, it's a real thing. So the fact that they bumped it to 300, and they made another revision to sixth gear to kind of give it a little extra. But I have a WR250R that'll do 80 miles on the highway now, right? Yeah. So, like, it's possible, but without a windshield, is it comfortable is really the question, right?
Yeah.
So
Now you're speaking of terms of you just beating the crap out of that bike that you had.
Yeah.
How many other bikes can you say that about, including, you know, all the other manufacturers? Do they other manufacturers have that same durability in the lightweight market?
Well, I mean, that's it's funny because that's the next article that was actually on my website. It was about Tale of Two Dual Sports, right? Because that's the thing, right? The 300L Rally is built out of being a true dual sport, and so it's adventurized to have extra creature comforts. It's a little heavier, and so to speak. I've rubbed elbows with people that have, you know, the Himalayan and have drowned them and beat the crap out of them. I worry a little bit about some of the European brands, and there's no question that, you know, when you take, we'll take KTM's 390 as example, like the 390 is born out of the Duke, the original one, not the new one, but the original was born out of the Duke, right? So anytime you take a street bike and you adventurize it, you take it off road, you're like, yeah, there's some key features here that weren't really designed to be here. And the T7 is no different, right? Like, you know, the oil covers or engine cases, they kind of stick out of the frame a lot more than a dual sport or a dirt bike would, right? So you're kind of asking for it after the fact.
But so no thought went into that. They just said, let's put some knobbies on it and call it an adventure bike.
It's complex, right? I think the most important question you're asking as far as maintenance goes, I think that's the biggest premium to the adventure space, is you can do some light off-roading and touring and enjoy it and not have to worry about doing all the work. If in the dual sport space, people are buying essentially race bikes with plates, right? And it's like, yeah, if you sell that kind of bike to an adventure person, they're like, oh my God, I've got to change the oil every 600 miles. That's insane, right? I don't feel like the lightweight adventure space is like that, and I think that's the advantage to that. To go with your previous comment, I also think that, love it or hate it, the truth is most people never really stray that far from gravel roads or forest service roads or relatively tame BDR stuff. Like, most of those people are doing relatively casual stuff. Now, it rains and you do dumb things and bad stuff happens, absolutely. But it's not quite the same as taking it on single track, racing it, you know, just flinging it at rocks, like, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
I think that most people who want to get into... I'm using ADV with, you know, air quotes here. I think people that want to get into that are not interested in the aggressive stuff, but more interested in the dirt road stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, I bike with all the bells and whistles is probably not needed, you know. But that's going to be a question that's coming up, but I wanted to ask you this now. Of all the manufacturers that are out there doing this or just building bikes, who's ignoring this market completely?
I'm right now, to your point, I think if we're talking, again, lightweight under 650, I think Yamaha has a gap. I'll circle back to that. I think Triumph is currently not interested in that space, but I think the leader for the most part is Ducati, and I'm not surprised by that.
Really?
I think Triumph and Ducati, for one reason or another, decided that they wanted to get into dirt bikes. I'm not sure if you've kept up with that or not. Both of them released actual race motocross bikes in the past, we'll call it 2 years. Okay. So I think they decided to go that route for whatever reason. I think a lot of it's, you know, off-road racing went nuts during COVID, right? Everybody grabbed their family, bought a camper, bought dirt bikes, and went and did all that.
And it went away.
I rode the wave, too. Like, I was out racing then, too.
All right.
So, but I have a hard time seeing Ducati wanting to play in that space. Like, they like that premium brand, and they command it pretty well, right? Like, you know, yeah. Ducati is what it is, and especially in the sport bike range. So I have a hard time seeing Ducati get in there, but I have an inkling that with as much partnership as Triumph is having with India, with as much, I assume, success they're having with that Scrambler 400, I wouldn't be surprised to see a Tiger Cub come out of Triumph, because they were talking about doing a street triple, and I think Tiger Cub got, what do they do that when they register it with the patent office or whatever it is? Like, sometimes they catch that, you know, like somebody's registered a trademark name, and so it gets released to the press, and everybody's like, oh, and I mean, that's actually how the, that Hero X-Pulse 421, like, they registered their name with Carb or whoever it was, and they're like, oh, yeah. Hero's gonna bring it back to the U.S., blah, blah, blah. So I would not be surprised to see Triumph do that. And Yamaha's the same, right? They dropped the bike that I have. They stopped making in 2020. So they have nothing from, the XT model. God, that XT is like, what, 2008? I forget how old that model is. They put fuel injection in it, I think, in 2013. So that bike is pretty much unchanged for now for 12 years, the XT 250. Yeah, but so to your point, right, from the XT 250 all the way to the T7, there's really nothing that's straight legal spokes, right?
No. So, I mean, if you look at I'm looking at Ducati's website right now. I mean, they have, of course, the Motard, and then the Hyper Motard, and of course, then you got your Desmoto 450s, and then you can get it. But they have the new Desert X.
Yeah, but it's like a 1,000cc, you know.
Yeah. So it's like, why? It's like, why?
But I mean, it's such a Ducati thing, though, right? Like, it is.
Of course.
It is, yeah, like, everything is performance. Like, yeah, it's a spicy meatball, right? You know, that's how I see it.
That's like, you know, but, let's shove the biggest engine we can into a minivan.
Yeah, but I mean, to Yamaha's point, like, KTM took the RC 390 Duke engine and, like, hey, all we got to do is put a fairing on the front and maybe some adjustable suspension, whatever, and we'll make an adventure bike, and they did. So right now, Yamaha has an R3 300cc twin. I think it's like 320cc's. And I'm like, I would not be shocked to see Yamaha, once they see how this KTM, this new 390 and the Himalayan 400 go, in the next 2 years, I would not be surprised if Yamaha brings out some kind of 350-ish adventure bike, yeah, or at least re-release the WR with a 300 in it. I mean, again, that's dual sport to me, not adventure, but I see them filling this space with a 300-something.
Yeah, you know, the thing is what the – now, we just had the AIM Expo show go off over there, and I have not – I'm a bad podcaster because I did not look at it at all because I didn't give a shit because I wasn't going.
Yeah.
So did you follow it at all? Did you see what was going on? Anything new?
That was actually my most recent episode with my friend Andy from Heavy Enduro, actually. They went out there, took a look at it, and we talked bikes. We spent probably more time talking about motorcycle shows, and he did break it down, and he said, yeah, it was much more about business and relationships. They did not bring a lot of bikes, unfortunately. It's not like it used to be with IMS and... You've been an Americade guy for the most part, from what I gather. Like,
yeah, I've been there a few times.
Yeah.
But I tell you what, and you know, and IMS, why it went away, I have no idea. But it was a great show, and because you got to see everybody there. But I think they're, you know, behind the scenes, they basically priced themselves out of work. You know, is what they did. Basically, what I heard, but they were charging vendors to set up, and everybody was telling them to go to hell. But yeah, that was a great show to see new stuff, and it's a shame. And the thing is, we don't have that anymore.
Yeah,
we don't. We just don't. And you can't. You can rely on the rallies to an extent.
Yeah.
You know, your major rallies, but they're focusing on the street market. They're really not talking about, you know, your off-road guys and your ATV stuff, you know.
I'm hopeful. I mean, we talk about that on the show. I've been to a couple off-road demo days here in Ohio. And that's what I give people some, like, huge chops for that. I'm like, man, when you go to a KTM off-road event, you get to ride these dirt bikes in the dirt at some local, you know, hair scramble track. Oh, my God, nothing's better than that, right? And so I think RevZilla's Get On ADV Fest had some demos. I think March Moto Madness, which is actually relatively close to you these days, I think they have done some demo stuff. March Moto Madness is Teleco Plains. I know that's not, like, super close to you.
Oh, but, Teleco. Yeah. No, it's a few hours away. In fact, you're probably closer.
That's how big that state is, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's out there. But I'll tell you what, you know, I'm definitely looking forward to like finding something like that. Because, well, just an example, we have, let's see, we got the Daytona coming up.
Yeah.
And, yeah, again, it's all street bar. It's all cruisers, and but there's really nothing ADV related going on around here. But moving on from that, I'm actually looking at the Himalayan right now.
Yeah,
and they're boasting their things here. So, but let's talk about the price point of all these bikes now. Is that something that's going to drive people towards or away? And on that, to add to that, with the addition of the lightweight market maybe happening, do you think that's going to pull more people into it?
Well, think about this: like if you're going to trailer a lot, or you're not really worried about the highway and you enjoy the back roads. I mean, that's me, right? Like I'm going to ride the back roads 4 hours to Kentucky than 3 hours on the highway. Screw that. Like I would rather take the extra hour and enjoy it, which means I don't need 80 miles an hour. Right. You can get into that new Himalayan 450 for what? $5,700, I think is what it is. And then ATM's bringing their brand new KTM 390 Adventure X and Adventure R. So you can get an X spec, which is pretty close to that Himalayan, and I think that was $5,900. Yeah, $5,900. You can have a spec'd up KTM. If you want the R, I think it's now $7,000. So their new super off-roady 390, which is head and shoulders above the old one, is $500 cheaper, and has way better suspension and all the extra stuff.
Right.
And I'll do a shout out to the Enduro too, because they like split the middle with those two. Again, I think we're technically debating dual sport, but they created a 390 Enduro with no windshield and all that stuff. I think that one's still like $5,500 or something like that. Like if you don't want a windshield or a tower and all that other stuff, like that is a killer deal on a bike. The only limitation with I think the Enduro is going to be that it's got a tiny gas tank. So I'm betting you're looking at 100-mile range, and that was it. When I had my 250L, I had to get gas every 95 miles. Like, there was just no way around that. But if you've ever had a Sportster, that's nothing new, right?
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. I mean, those funny things, I'm looking at this. I'm actually looking at the Himalayan 250, and it's $6,000.
250? You mean the old Himalayan 410?
Yeah, sorry, the 410. It's $6,000 for that. And I haven't looked at the 450, so I'm afraid.
Yeah, I'm pretty confident that they're offering $5,700 for that new Himalayan 450. I could have a typo here, but I think the 410 is $5,500, and I think the new 450 is $5,700. And it's messy, right? Because I websites, Lord help you. If you've been to KTM's website, or even as much as I love Royal Enfield, their website's still like, look at the videos. I'm like, I'm just here for the numbers, dude.
Yeah, I'm just here for the exact. Exactly. Yeah. No. I take that back. The all new Himalayan 450 is $6,000.
Yeah. And I think that's the custom color too. I think if you get the base model, I think it's marginally cheaper than that. Could be wrong about that.
211. Let me see. What's the 211 going for?
Because it's got to be. You know how they are. They want. Yeah.
It's you know what. And here's what's stupid, right? So $6,000 for the new 450, but for $500 less, you get the 411.
Yeah.
That's stupid.
Yeah, I think what's happened is, obviously, I'm friends with a lot of dealers locally, and they're, you know, we've been talking about this for a while. It's another one of those things. Had the Himalayan 450 come to the States any sooner, I probably would have bought that instead of the T7, but that's a different discussion. Yeah. I think what they did is, I think they made so many Himalayans that they were starting to get a little stacked up, and they're going to end up discounting a bunch of those to get them sold, unfortunately.
Yeah, just get rid of them.
The Scram 411s is the same thing. Like, the Scram 411's an awesome bike, but unfortunately, there were too many colors, too many options, and, I mean, that's a Harley conversation right there, right? Like, you can only have so many trim levels and manage the inventory, right? What was the other thing? Oh, CF Moto. We didn't talk about that. We really should. CF Moto's IBEX 450. Mm-hmm. They're asking $6,500 for that. And if you're a bells and whistles customer and you're not scared off by the Chinese thing, that is a killer deal, because that's spoked rims, tubeless tires, and a whole bunch of electronic goodies. It is the premium package, and it's cheaper than a KTM. And it's a twin cylinder instead of a single cylinder, so it's going to be marginally more comfortable. So all the reviews have been good.
Should people be afraid of that? Because it's a new bike, Chinese motor. Should they be concerned about that because we don't know if it's, you know, tried and true and tested, or should we go with all reliable, dare I say, the KTM?
let's throw the log on the fire. So the last BMW 850, what, the F850 GS? I think, okay, I think, yeah. Longxin in China, I think that's who made that engine.
So the, no kidding.
And I'm pretty confident that the current BMW 900 may also be an outsourced engine not built in Germany. I don't know. Right. I'm not going to say it's China right off the top of my head, but I do believe it's also outsourced to Southeast Asia somewhere. But we know for a fact that the Germans tested, they trusted the Chinese to make the engine.
So they designed it and said, here, build this.
And so KTM, they licensed CF Moto to make the 790 engine. So the current, if you buy, I think it's accurate, the current 790, if you buy it now, I think that 790 engine that you're buying in the United States is built in China. Now, okay. Listeners now are going off, I'm sure, as they're listening, like, oh yeah, but they're having all those recalls on the KTM. Like, I know, like we can debate KTM some other time, that's fine.
Well, you know what? Not for anything, but you've heard of Janus Motorcycles,
yeah,
of course,
absolutely.
Right? Now, they're using the Chinese mm-hmm. engine. And they've got their new 450, which I had a chance to ride up in Sturgis. What was it called? The Griffin
yep.
450.
That thing's rad.
And it's crazy, right? I rode the prototype.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. So it's, hey, you got this 450 Chinese engine, and everybody's loving it already. They're loving it. So I think, I guess reliability and questionable reliability is going to be a thing of... it's a wait and see.
Well, I would say that there's a lot of Chinese stuff that I would say that about, and I personally, this is my personal opinion, I still feel this way about SSR and Benelli. I think SSR and Benelli are quite established and relatively reliable. The difference to me, and I will throw Covey in here in a second, CF Moto has also been making side-by-sides in the U.S. for like a really long time. So they actually have an existing dealer network to some degree that's been here longer. They've been in side-by-sides longer than they've been into motorcycles, the best I can tell.
Yeah.
So is there a reliability issue there? Absolutely. But we now have, when you have CF Moto being a partner with KTM and you have KTM's dealer network, to me it's not as scary as it used to be, right? Where it's like, I bought this Chinese bike and it came to my house in a crate and I had to put it all together and I can't go to any dealers to get parts. Like, yeah, that's a little sketchy.
Which brings me to another good point.
Go ahead.
Which brings me to that. Okay. The dealer networks, people are gonna who are gonna buy these bikes are gonna need some sort of support.
Yeah.
So of all of these light with this lightweight market, this here, this we'll say 650 and below. Okay. Who has the best dealer network to deal with?
Well, I mean, Honda, unquestionably, right? Like again, that CRF300L is gonna come out here, like, and they're ubiquitous, right? Like if you Google mm-hmm. CRF250L right now on Facebook Marketplace, there'll be, you know, tons of choices, you know, to pick from. And that engine, again, has been around since, I think, 2013. It's funny because I'm going on a tangent here, but the CBR 250R got a bump to 300 in like 2015, but they didn't put that same engine into the dual sport until like 2021. But I'm saying, like, all these parts they're in the system, right? Like, so that stuff's been there. And I think Royal Enfield is hot to trot on this. It's me, it's my opinion, but I think that it's coming. Like here in I'm in Southern Ohio, but the Northern Kentucky Indian dealer is also a Royal Enfield dealer. We have a Royal Enfield dealer here in Dayton. There's definitely one, several in Columbus. Like I'm not more than 50 minutes away from a Royal Enfield dealer. So there's lots of options. KTM is all over the place. They used to have like street dealers and off-road dealers that were kind of separate, just because the customer is very different. But most of the KTM dealers locally, they have everything. So if you're looking at an orange bike, you can get that. Kawasaki.
Yeah, you know what I find interesting about the dealership market, and the deal, you know, it's just that with most any dealership out there, you have to definitely go to the internet and look at where are they located, and you got to go search for it. And if you're in one of those not very populated states, smaller states, you're taking a ride,
right?
Obviously, which cracks me up, because then you got a company like my brand, Harley Davidson. Mm-hmm. You can't swing a dead cat without hitting a Harley Davidson dealer, right? And they're the one, and you're talking about companies missing the mark. Harley-Davidson is the one company that's totally absent from that smaller market, which annoys the crap out of me. I mean, the Pan America is a great bike. It is a really good bike. You just don't, you know, they have the ability to get that 950 out there. They've already got the 950 engine.
Yeah.
But they're not putting it where it needs to be.
100%.
They're not. And it just blows my mind.
I'm actually anxious to talk with you more about this. And, you know, it's so much detraction from the topic. I mean, at some point we should get together about it. I think Harley and Ducati, as I mentioned earlier, they have the same problem, right? To some degree, BMW does too, but I don't understand how you can have a 310 GS and you can have a Chinese-built engine, and BMW is still, you know, like, they're the mothership in the adventure space still, right, with the GS and all that stuff. Like, how do they do that? But it's like Ducati and Harley act like they're going to water down their brand if they sell what they we call entry-level bikes. It's so weird.
There is such there's a massive market out there. You and I both know that. There's a massive market out there for that sub 800-900 market. There's that market there. Granted, Harley has an 883. That's good. Fine. Did have an 883. Right. They did. But then they're just not. We're not. No, they're not doing that. Yeah. And I just, and even Ducati, they're just not touching. It's like, maybe they're just, these guys got it. We'll just focus on what we focus on. That they're just missing it. I don't know.
It is wild, right? Because I think of, as we segue, I think of the, what was the name of that 500 that they made?
The Street.
Yeah, that's right. The Street 500. And it was funny because I was like super pumped when they finally did that Street 750 because they had like that Street Bob thing, whatever it was. I was so into it at the time, but it's funny when you looked at a traditional Harley and then you looked at that and the fit and finish and you were just like, what is this unfinished thing that you've done? But at the same time, BMW outsources their 310 GS to China. KTM has got a Bajaj engines out of India, and it's like all these other European premium brands have figured out how to do this, and it just seems like Harley's like, nope, don't want to mess with it. Like,
okay. And well, you know, they do have that Chinese one that they just released, the X750, I think they call it. Or the X500 or something like that.
I didn't know if that was going to happen in the States or not.
Yeah. No, it's not. Mm. It's what I've seen so far, it's only in China.
Yeah.
But come on. Bring it over here. Let's see what happens.
I'd love to have you on the show and talk just Harley Davidson, right? Because it's like, what is up with Harley Davidson these days is a fascinating thing.
I bleed orange and black, man. But you know, that's me. But that's like great. But then when I see them, it's got to be management. I don't know. We'll talk about that later. But on the subject of AD bikes and riding in ADV, so this is an interesting question, and I think you're going to have fun with this one. Is the whole thing becoming crowded, and maybe is it becoming faddish almost?
It's hilarious to me to have been in this space pretty much nonstop since what, 2015 or so, definitely 2016, right? Like, I've been in this for a decade, and I think it just hit me in the past 12 months that I was like, oh my god, ADV is now a lifestyle thing. Like, it's like, it, like, I didn't even think about it, right? Like I'm this, you know, utilitarian guy. Like, nothing gets modified on my bike unless it's necessary and blah, 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 blah. And that's it. Like, we've made jokes about the Starbucks guys forever, right? Like, that's kind of been a thing. But, yeah, I'm at the rally. I'm reading articles. And I'm just looking around. And I was like, oh, my God, we're now at that space, right? Like, we really, we buy our uniforms and we dress up in our climb gear and our you know, Power Rangers stuff. And we go out on our adventure bikes and ride around the city. It's like, no, yeah, AEV has officially become somewhat of a lifestyle brand.
It's a thing now.
Yeah, and it's not, I don't think it's crowded. And I don't think it's going to kill the brand. But we all have to understand that if you're into motorcycles, congratulations, you're a member of a cult, right? So we're people.
You know, it's funny because, like, I watch a lot of YouTube videos, and it, while there are a tremendous amount of, you know, street bike videos, sport bike guys, Harley guys, and you get just a whole bunch of them, the people who ride off-road, there are a boatload of them. Yeah. Oh, my God. You name it, there's people out there making content who ride off-road, going around the world, and naturally you look at it and you go, I want to do that. And then, you know, next thing you know, there's 600 people all looking to buy an ADV bike. But I have to wonder if this is going to lead to a thing, because naturally we have the BDRs that everybody can do, which is great. It's wonderful. But at some point, I wonder if something's going to happen, and the Bureau of Land Management in the country is going to say, all right, we got to knock it off.
Yeah.
Is land access going to be a problem?
I actually think I believe all this is also a generational shift. And I think it's related, like all these questions interlace to lots of other things that I was thinking about, some of the stuff earlier today. I think that pragmatism is also related to price. I think the younger generation is more pragmatic and less worried about what people think of them riding on a bike and are more interested in just having it. I also think that they're more community driven and community based. And so to answer your question, I'm rubbing elbows with more and more people who are forming clubs, forming groups, forming charities that are deliberately working to keep the roads open. And I'm talking about here on the East Coast. I'm not even talking about the mess that's out west that I know they have some pretty heavy stuff they're dealing with. But here on the East Coast, we have Backroads of Appalachia. Danny Boone Backcountry Byway has its own board. That's basically the majority of the stuff. We do a Red River Scramble. So Danny Boone Backcountry Byway is like a BDR. It was created in 2016 before BDRs really kind of became big. And they're primarily for Jeeps, but obviously there's a lot of motorcycle influence, and obviously I fill it up one day a year, right, or one weekend a year. They're the same way. They work directly with the counties, and in Appalachia, we're all learning, right? Like, most of the corporations have taken all the profitable stuff out of the ground already, so now the last thing that we could do is, make money off the ground, and that works great because we can bring people in as tourists. They spend their money here, and, we enjoy riding off-road. So is it a concern of mine? 100%. But I think that the younger community is realizing what's happening, and we're trying to prevent that from going on, and I'm actively networking with these people. I mean, I'm holding an event for this reason. So,
yeah. I definitely think there needs to be more awareness for land access, especially when it comes to out west, because there's a lot of sensitive land areas out there. Even on the East Coast, like you're talking about the Appalachian region, all the way up through, all the way up through Maine.
Yeah.
I know there's, especially, well, I'll even say in New York, because I'm familiar with New York, land access restrictions are pretty high. Like at the Adirondacks, for example.
Yeah.
Very tough up there in that area.
It's obviously this is my specialty, right? I talked about the weather earlier, and it's like, well, what do you do in the winter? I'm like, well, I plan the rally, I lay out routes, I create graphics, like I do all the inside work, right? And so I'm just studying maps of the property lines, right? And so when you work these relationships with the local counties and whatnot, it's marginally easier to not, don't pet the locals the wrong way. And we still have issues with that. In Kentucky, it's some jerk is mad that side-by-sides rolled down the road at 3 o'clock in the morning and throwing beer cans, and they put up a gate, right? And I think everybody listening is like, yeah, I'd be pissed too, right? So that's not new. But ideally, if we continue to forge a relationship with the locals, and to me, especially motorcyclists, because I think Jeep people and ADV guys get along pretty well. I can get along with side-by-side folks, but there's no question that a lot of these guys like to, get loaded at 3 o'clock in the morning, turn all the bright lights on, and, do what they do. I've witnessed it. It happens. I get it.
No, I get it.
It's you can wheel and drink at the same time. You can't ride and drink at the same time, so it kind of prohibits that. Anyway, I think we continue to build those relationships, and I want to continue to foster more of that, so I hope people listening pick up on that.
All right. Okay. Well, one more question, and I don't know if this is related to, I guess it could be related to the ADV region. Is the Scrambler dead?
No, I actually think it's related to the previous thing. I definitely feel the influence slowing, right? Yeah. There's no doubt that it's like, Scramblers are awesome. Can we do a low pipe? It's kind of funny how that's become the thing.
Can
right?
we do a low pipe?
As the spokesman of all Scramblers, as I sometimes become sometimes. I love the high pipes, right? It's a thing. But yeah, the vast majority of owners want no part of that, as it turns out, and it's kind of disappeared. But I think it's related to my previous comment, right? Like, if you're price conscious and you want a few more CCs and you're going to spend more time on the pavement, then, a scrambler works out pretty well because you're still getting that, like, I mean, you know how it is. Like, you can look at a bike on paper, but how it looks and how it feels is really what makes you make the purchase, right?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah, you know, of course.
Scramblers are full of character, and they look awesome, and you want to be seen on, you know, doing things on them. But also, they're marginally easier to work on. You know, it's typically that they're a little more naked and they don't have all the extra adornments and stuff. And they can get a little, you know, they can go a little off-road. And the really cool thing to me about scramblers is that's the one bike that when it's dirty, it looks better. So it's a little more utilitarian and functional, even though it's, you know, it's totally a styling thing for the most part. But I think that's the same thing, right? If people want to get into, we'll call it adventure camping style stuff, scramblers aren't a bad thing. And I think, again, they're relatively affordable. I think the younger folks are still going to hold on to that, at least for a little bit longer. But you're right, it's getting a little long in the tooth.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I remember why I went to the IMS show a few years back, and I happened to see, I always had an interest in the Triumph Scrambler.
Yeah.
And I had a chance to see the Scrambler, I think it was the Scrambler 1200, does that sound right?
Yeah, it's a beast.
And I saw the bike in person, and I was like, oh my God, this thing is a monster.
It's enormous.
It is huge. Yeah. I'm like, no.
You buy a ladder when you buy one of those. It's
I
would, incredible.
You know, you might as well. I thought when I first saw it, I said, you might as well just get an ADV bike.
Yeah, you're poking the bear pretty hard right now because I remember when I first bought mine in 16 and how stoked I was. Like, oh, we got to put some like real suspension on this, and everybody's telling me in the industry, like, oh, it's coming, and they launched that 1200, and that's it. It's like, okay, so now you want $16,000. I got 1200 cc's, which only gets me off the cliff faster. Like, I don't need the extra poke to crash. It's got killer suspension and all that stuff, but it's so big and it's so heavy and it's so tall, and it's like, yeah, I don't have the talent for this. Like, it just
But then again, next to it they had the 450, and I said, oh well, this is more like it.
That new Scrambler 400 is fun. I actually like the Street 400 better, a different conversation, but the new Scrambler 400 is a blast. That new single is a hoot. It's all kinds of fun to ride.
Yeah.
I see them putting a fairing on the front of that, and I think we're going to see a Tiger Cub 400.
I'm wishful thinking?
I'm holding my thumb in the air, but I'm guessing. I think we'll see Triumph drop a Tiger Cub 400. Because they put a fairing on the front of the Trident, and that's how we got the Tiger 660. They have all the tools. Like, I don't see any reason why they don't do this, other than they don't like to cannibalize all their options sometimes.
And you know, it's priced right too at $5,700 bucks, so it's right there in the pocket.
Absolutely.
That's a good spot. All right, how can people learn more about you, your podcast, and Motor Adventure blog you got going?
MotoAdventurer with an R on the end .com. You can look up Moto Adventurer Unscripted on Spotify. And if you are dirt curious at all, please out to RedRiverScramble.com. The rally is hosted this October. All bikes, all brands. And if you don't want to ride off-road, no problem. Don't. I got more pavement routes than you can ride in an entire weekend. So
good luck. Oh, man. I see you have a video there, the Red River Scramble video on your. I am going to watch that. I'm going to watch that because I am dirt curious.
It's the whole reason we host it is, you know, in 2017, it was a pizza meetup on a Saturday. We had 12 guys from six states, and it's just one of those, like, just come out and do this. And everybody's like, why is it called a scramble? I'm like, just bring your bike, and people bring street bikes and go down a gravel road, and suddenly the hook is set. And that's the whole point. It's like, just come out and have a good time. We're not here to race. We're not here to beat stuff up. Just come out and see the scenery.
Cool. Have you done any of the BDRs yet?
I've done parts of Midwest BDR. The problem is my wife had some health complications in 2018, and so I tend to stay a little closer to home. So I do trip a lot, and that's the thing. Like, everything's in Kentucky. I'm like, well, when you're 45 minutes from the Ohio River and you have an adventure bike, I get there very quickly.
Hey, any closing words on those considering getting their first ADV bike?
I'm going to tell you the advice that none of us heed, and that is lighter is better. What typically happens is most people spend thousands of dollars on a really nice adventure bike, and they take it off-road, and they drop it, and they go, this is hard, and I don't like it. But if you go into it with a very affordable small bike, like a 300L Rally, you can bemoan that the bike is a dog, but you feel more confident off-road and you're more likely to enjoy the experience. And I think the biggest thing is the allure to adventure is that some of the best views are just not on paved roads. And you get to enjoy it with just an intimate group of whoever you brought with you most of the time.
Awesome. Drew, hey, I want to thank you very much for being on the podcast. You know, we got to get together again, and we got a lot of topics to talk about. We can bang out a lot of stuff and annoy a lot of people, I'm sure.
Anytime.
Thanks a lot. Don't go anywhere. I want to talk to you when we're done. But thanks for being on the show. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
The Motorcycle Men Podcast is supporting David's Dream and Believe Cancer Foundation. If you would like to help and be a part of something that actually makes a difference, donate today to David's Dream and Believe Cancer Foundation. Go to davidsdreamandbelieve.org to donate. Links will be in the show notes. And, of course, the Gold Star Ride Foundation, helping families of fallen soldiers and making a difference in the lives of those left behind. If you'd like to be a part of a great cause and get some heartfelt miles in, get on over to goldstarride.org and learn how you can participate in the next Gold Star Ride. And hey, thanks for joining me and Drew from the Moto Adventurer blog and the Moto Adventurer Unscripted podcast here in the V-Twin Cafe, where we talked about the lightweight ADV market. Now, you can learn more about Drew and his blog and podcast by getting over to motoadventurer.com. That's one word. motoadventurer.com. Links will be in the show notes and, of course, on the Motorcycle Men website at motomenpc.com. And don't forget to get on over to the Ride with Ted YouTube channel to watch some of the many videos I have there. And if you would please also like and subscribe, that would be a tremendous help to the channel and, of course, to the podcast. And hey, don't forget to get a copy of my book. That's right, get on over to Amazon. You can get a copy of my book, The Road Most Traveled. It's available in ebook and paperback. The audiobook is on its way. It's coming, kids. So get yourself a copy of that book. It's a great book. I like it. Okay. Hey, for the rest of the Motorcycle Men team, thanks for listening. And remember, boys and girls, we say stupid crap so you don't have to. Ride safe, kids.